You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
And breathe, Lionel.
Breathe. Oh yeah,
and breathe. You can breathe now. You can. It's we're almost there. We're at the end of our grandest tour. How do you feel?
What am I going to do tomorrow? That's what I'm worried. What? I'm actually worried about that. Actually, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow. I'm making a butter pie tomorrow. I kid you not. There we are.
We're also recording a podcast tomorrow.
Oh crikey! It's not the end then, is it? I mean, the podcast's going to continue. It's just not going to be released daily. For a while, until the Grand Tours next year.
Absolutely, can't wait. Bring them on. Well, that's Lionel Burney. I'm Richard Moore, and we're joined once again for our final stage of the Grandest Tour by Ian Boswell. Hello, Ian.
Hey, Richard. Hey, Lionel. It's nice to be here for the final day, and I wasn't here throughout, but yeah, congratulations to both of you for finishing. There was no DNFs in this first inaugural Grandest Tour.
No, we've made it to the end. I skipped a stage. Lionel skipped a few, but, you know, it's a team sport, isn't it? And we've made it to the end. And in tonight's episode, we'll obviously recap what happened on the final day of the Vuelta a España in Madrid. And I think we'll have a bit of a rambly look back, won't we, on the last 5 weeks and pick up a few bits and pieces, moments that have left an impression on us, things that we might have learned from this weird truncated season. And we will be returning to our weekly episodes this coming week. The first one will be a press conference episode, so we've got lots of questions for that. Thank you very much indeed for them. There'll also be an episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina coming out this week as well. As I speak, our Pedlar de Charme poll is it's narrowing the lead. Sepp Kuss currently leads, but Hugh Carthy is closing on him. Now, Sepp Kuss had a huge number of votes, partly because his team, Jumbo-Visma, tweeted it and encouraged their followers to vote for him. And that's absolutely fine. He'd be a more than worthy winner. But it is narrowing. And when you listen to this, you'll still be able to vote. So get on Twitter and vote for your Pedlar de Charme. It is between David Godu, Chris Froome, Hugh Carthy, and Sepp Kuss.
How many days are we going to allow for votes to come in? And then are we going to count postal votes? I mean, what's the protocol here?
Oh.
Count every vote.
Stop the count! Every vote counts, Lionel. Every vote counts. No, we're not. We don't take postal votes. I should make that clear. And the winner will get a beautiful one-off Stacey Snyder mug. And Lionel, you said that you're currently sipping beer from your beer. What is it? A beer cup?
It's a beer cup. It's over a pint. It holds. I think it's sort of half a litre, 500 milliliters. It's a lovely.
That's less than a pint. That's less than a pint, Lionel. I have to correct you there.
It definitely holds a pint, and it definitely holds half a litre in that case. anyway, it's a beautiful pint glass-shaped ceramic cup. I've got the Tour de France one. I bought this myself. It wasn't a gift from Stacey. I was very happy to buy it and ensure that a contribution goes towards the charities that we were raising money for during the tour. And it's got the beautiful bicycle motifs on it. A real lovely piece of work, honestly. A real pleasure to sip a nice cold beer out of on to celebrate Mark the end of the Grandest Tour.
And Stacey is part of the team really as well, isn't she? She does a great job producing these beautiful cups, cappuccino sets and beer cups, and all the money goes to good causes. So at the Giro and the Vuelta, we raise money for the Bahati Foundation in LA and the Black Cyclist Network in the UK. And a lot of money has been raised. Stacey's just totting it up now, actually. But what are the headlines from Madrid, please, Lionel?
Well, Richard, two Vuelta champions were crowned today. Astonishing, though that sounds. Chris Froome received his trophy for the 2011 Vuelta, which he was awarded after Juan José Cobo was stripped of that title for a doping offence. Remember, Chris Froome found out that he'd won the 2011 Vuelta while he was in intensive care after his crash at the Critérium du Dauphiné last year, and finally was presented with the trophy at the start today. The start of stage 18 was at the horse racing circuit, the Hipódromo de la Zarzuela, And the riders lined up there for the final gallop to Madrid. They reached the Madrid circuit, which was altered slightly, so it was a slightly different shape to usual. Usually it takes in a bit more of the city, but they just sort of went up and down a bit today, didn't they? And well, the only real action in terms of a breakaway was Tim Wellens of Lotto and Willie Smith of BH Burgos got away. They were then joined by Gonzalo Serrano of Caja Rural and finally by Dmitry Gruzdev of Astana. But they were caught, and then we had a proper sprint finish for the final stage. And Pascal Ackermann of Bora Hansgrohe, well, he galloped the fastest and got his second stage win of the race. If you remember, his first stage win was on stage 9 when he was promoted from second place to first, when Sam Bennett was stripped of the win for barging Emils Leopans in the sprint. So this was Ackermann's first proper win. Sam Bennett himself was second, and Max Kanter of Sunweb was third, cantering over the line. Perhaps if he'd galloped, he would have won the stage. I don't know.
Oh, sorry, my goodness me.
Sorry, everyone. Sorry. It's been a long Grandis Tour. Primoz Roglic then has clinched back-to-back Vuelta titles, the first back-to-back winner since Roberto Heras, who won three in a row from 2003 to 2005. Roglic also won the points competition for the second year in a row. Guillaume Martin won the King of the Mountains. Enric Mas is the best young rider for Movistar. And Movistar cleaned up in the teams classification again. They won their 12th Vuelta teams classification. The first one was as Benesto back in 1994. They also won it as Castapan. And the last 3 years now, they've won the teams classification. Bit of a speciality for them. The rest of the individual podium, of course, Richard Carapaz in second and Hugh Carthy in third. And Chris Froome, who I mentioned at the start, well, he finished his last race for Sky/Ineos and will move to Israel Startup Nation next year. So a real end of an era in a way. But there we are, Primoz Roglic, the Vuelta champion, after finishing second in the Tour and winning Liège-Bastogne-Liège in a really impressive, very compact racing season for the Slovenian.
And in the finale to the three-day women's race, the what was the Madrid Challenge? Now, the Serratizit Challenge, I hope I'm saying that correctly. That's a team as well, of course. It used to be WNT, which is a lot easier to say. And their rider, Lisa Brenner, won for the second year in a row. It was a circuit race in Madrid on the same circuit as the men raced on later on. That was won by Elisa Balsamo ahead of Lorena Vibas, who won a couple of days ago, and Marta Bastianelli third. Very interesting concept with sprints every two laps, every other lap, basically, for a time bonuses. And that, you know, that was really quite an interesting, something you'd probably like, Lionel. You like these kind of gimmicks and quirks. But it did make it quite an interesting race. And Brenner, who won the time trial, really had to race quite smartly to win overall. And well, we'll talk about it a bit more in the Cycling Podcast Feminine this week.
I do like the idea of that. I've always said that a track points race style race on the road on a good circuit would be entertaining as part of a Grand Tour, rather than, I know that the Hammer Series has really mixed up the format of racing, hasn't it, as a standalone event, but I don't see why you couldn't have that kind of, certainly when you know, perhaps early in the Tour de France, a stage with laps like that with big bonus points for the green jersey, just anything to make riders think differently, make everyone pay attention a bit more, especially on the sort of flatter stages where, you know, we do just assume it will be a break, a chase and a sprint. But I'm not running these races, so it's not really down to me.
You're not UCI president yet, are you?
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker. If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
As our Grandest Tour comes to an end, let's hear once more from Will Hayes of iWocker, who was part of the mini peloton of riders who cycled from London to Brighton to raise money for the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust, which has a number of initiatives to work towards creating a fairer society for all, including encouraging companies to diversify their recruitment. Let's hear from Will about the ride.
It was actually quite an interesting one. Obviously, we've not had an opportunity to cycle together for a while, so streaming people into the three different groups was quite a bit of guesswork. There was quite a lot of competition between the what was supposed to be the first and second groups, especially since the first group managed to take a wrong turn, trying to find their way out of London. Quite a lot of the time we were kind of neck and neck. We'd see them for a bit, then we'd dive onto different routes and meet up with them later. But then towards the second half of the ride, I think they slowed down a bit and we got to Brighton about an hour ahead.
Well, Iwoca is a company that has really embraced cycling, either as a mode of transport for commuting or as a leisure activity. And it counts among its customers a number of companies in the cycling industry too. They're working to make it easier and simpler for small and medium-sized companies to borrow the money they need to cope with seasonality in their business or to recruit, invest or innovate for the next step in their growth and development. To find out more about Iwoca, go to iwoca.co.uk.
Well, as expected, our sprint finish in Madrid, there was a breakaway of Tim Wellens in it, who's won two stages, of course, but never looked like staying away. And it was a sort of battle in the end between Bora Hansgrohe and de Koninck Quickstep and their sprinters, Pascal Ackermann and Sam Bennett. Jasper Philipsen, fourth on the stage, and he's the other sprinter. It was put to Ackermann at the finish, actually, whether he was considered himself the best sprinter with two stage wins, but he said that he didn't count the one that he inherited when Sam Bennett was relegated, interestingly enough. I noticed Emil's Leapins today keeping well out of the way in 12th, actually. He was kind of up there, but not getting too close to Sam Bennett, I don't think. Michael Morkov, who kept an audio diary for us at the Tour de France, of course, and is Sam Bennett's lead out man, quite interesting afterwards, talked about that they took it on quite early and maybe did a bit too much. And then in the end, I think Bennett was out of position a bit and Morkov had to do quite a lot of work to get him back into position. And then he had quite a lot to do to get around Ackermann and probably a fair result. It was close in the end, but that elusive 100th Grand Tour stage win is still, it's still elusive for de Koninck Quickstep, isn't it?
It is, Richard, but not for the lack of trying for de Koninck Quickstep in the final week of the Vuelta, but they'll have to wait till the Giro next year, won't they? So, but I'm sure they'll get that win eventually.
Oh, I think so.
It might come along quite quickly at the Giro next year.
Yes, I'm sure they will, Lionel. I mean, I suppose my overriding feeling today, I kind of spoke in last night's episode about the anticipated nostalgia of watching yesterday's mountaintop finish and realizing it was the last, you know, proper bike racing that we were going to see in this strange year. And a tweet from Thomas de Gendt yesterday caught my eye. He said, "I gave it 1% chance for it to happen at the season restart." The races, he means. "But thanks to the efforts of organisers, teams, sponsors and public, we will finish the Grand Tours in Paris, Milan and Madrid. It gives me hope that we will have a normal season in 2021. I mean, the odds that I would have given it were probably not dissimilar. And even speaking to team doctors and so on, when the rescheduled calendar was announced, they gave it very little chance of all these races. I mean, we've lost Paris-Roubaix, we lost the Amstel Gold Race, but most of the races have been run, and most amazingly, the three Grand Tours have been run in their entirety. And, you know, I think a lot of us have been reflecting on that the last few days. The Vuelta, by all accounts, has been exceptionally well organised. Michael Morkov spoke about that as well. But it's been quite an achievement, I think, by the sport. And it's difficult to know who to credit the most. The UCI obviously came up with the plan. It was then up to the organisers and especially, I think, teams and riders to implement the plans. And I think, I mean, we saw at the Giro a few glitches and issues. And there was a moment at the Giro where it looked very unlikely that it was going to make it all the way through. But I think I would single out the teams and the riders, actually, because I think it's a great credit to them that they have followed the rules and really lived as they often do, like monks, and made lots of sacrifices and not seen their families and so on. And Cesare Benedetti spoke about that in his Giro diary for us, that it asked a lot of them, and you know, they've delivered on that and ensured that we've had racing, and it's been quite, I'd say, quite an achievement.
Yeah, I think it gives confidence that next season won't be quite so disrupted. I mean, of course, we don't know what's going to happen with coronavirus, but we must assume it's going to be with us in you know, either this level of severity or perhaps even slightly more serious, or, you know, it will ease off again. Perhaps, you know, it's going to be a fluctuation over the coming months. But I think cycling has shown that it can adapt and thrive in these very peculiar circumstances. In a way, I mean, I remember talking about cycling's, you know, unique vulnerability almost to coronavirus, because the peloton is basically 180 riders all shoulder to shoulder, coughing and sneezing and you know, emptying their noses all over each other for 4 hours a day, and then all staying in the same hotel and all being in the same bus and so on, thinking that that would make cycling more vulnerable than perhaps it's turned out to be. Whereas I think that once the races are in their bubble, it gives a reasonably good chance of things proceeding. Whereas I'm looking at kind of the Champions League football or even the Premier League football, where teams are kind of in and out of their bubbles, aren't they? They're not all together for, you know, weeks at a time. They all go home, they all have a family or social life, they're probably mixing with, you know, in inverted commas, ordinary people or non-bubble people more. And so I think that cycling can kind of manage things, even if it's extreme and extraordinary at times. I suppose, you know, the one thing we hope for is that next season there's less of this kind of intense demand on people all in a very short space of time. And perhaps the most pragmatic thing to do would be to say that if something gets cancelled because of coronavirus, that it's just cancelled and it isn't slotted in again in, you know, September, October, November. And that would give everybody working in the sport a sort of sense of clarity and of what they're going to be expected to do. So yeah, fingers crossed, you know, 2021 will look a little bit more like the season that we're used to.
Yeah, well, that kind of brings us to, you know, something we discussed last night is how, you know, how will 2021 look as far as just the schedule being reshuffled and kind of reorganized. And we, you know, we're lucky. I mean, as fans, we were extremely lucky this year that the races happened, and, you know, oftentimes having multiple races on the same day was great during the moment, because a lot of us are still kind of locked down and not living our normal lives. But, you know, how does that look next year when kind of people's lives hopefully are more back to normal, and, you know, having three big races on one single day, is that something that the UCI and teams want to continue doing, or is this now an opportunity for the schedule to be reshuffled for the future?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. Richard, you made a very quick throwaway comment a few stages ago about what you would do with the sort of the peak of the season, that from the Tour de France through to the end, which really sort of interested me. And I think that there is a way to reshape the calendar and make it better for fans, more understandable. Having things in sort of blocks of like-minded races, if you like. And I've just been sketched out a calendar. Bear with me here. So I'm thinking, so the World Tour calendar should work on the basis that there should never be a clash. So one World Tour race on at a time. And February and March, you could have the week-long stage races, the Tour of the Basque Country, or Itzulia as it's now called, the Tour of Catalonia, Paris-Nice, Tirreno-Adriatico, and the Binc Banc Tour. Bear with me. But the Binc Banc Tour would be a kind of classics warm-up for a spring of cobble classics. April would just be the cobbly-type classic. Het Nieuwsblad, Gent-Wevelgem, Harelbeke, Dwars door Vlaanderen, Tour of Flanders, De Panne, Paris-Roubaix. May would be for the Giro, and then in June you'd have your warm-up stage races for the Tour de France, the Dauphiné, the Tour de Suisse, and the Tour of Poland. So the Tour of Poland wouldn't be kind of, you know, shoved in when everyone is, you know, kind of over the Tour de France. The Tour de France in July, of course, and then, Richard, your idea of having a summer stretch of classics, and I think Strade Bianche, Milan-San Remo and Il Lombardia all together, that worked really well. I think that was the outstanding kind of change that added something, made you feel like there was a sense that this thing was building towards. You know, there was a clarity, wasn't there? Something to look forward to each weekend, and it teased different riders out. I mean, it might change the types of riders that target those races, but that's fine. Then you go into the Ardennes races. Well, Amstel Gold, not technically the Ardennes, but Amstel Gold, Flesh Wallon, Liège, Bastogne-Liège, then the World Championships, and then the Vuelta would actually be in October, and then we'd run that through to late October, because I think that's actually worked. And climate-wise, the Vuelta would probably stand a better chance of being held a little bit later on in the year, and it would also give a bit more of a break between the Tour and the Vuelta, and everyone's appetite would be sort of refreshed and renewed, ready for another Grand Tour.
I agree in principle with that. Mine was a bit simpler. Keep the semi-classics, Strada Bianca, the Gent-Wevelgem's E3, those races in the spring, but really have a lot of the smaller stage races around then, building up to the Giro, then some more stage races before the Tour. But the Tour at the moment forms a kind of climax to the season, and you know, what I loved this year was the great revenge match at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. You know, that is a race where we should see those riders, the guys that can win the Tour de France. And we don't now, because they tend to be away at altitude, or, you know, they're fitting it in, they're squeezing it into their schedule rather than, you know, trying to actually perform well there. Riders come out of the Tour with a lot of them quite good form, and you could have a really meaningful block of racing to follow that. You know, you could have on consecutive weekends Milan-San Remo, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and the Lombardia. Why not? And yeah, shift the Vuelta a little bit later in the year. And Ian was talking last night about how hot, you know, it usually is at the Vuelta. Well, this has been, the Vuelta has looked fantastic. Yeah, it's been cold some days, but and I wouldn't have it as late as this, but it has kind of worked.
The only issue I'd take with that is the spring then is a void. I mean, there's something magical about having the cobbled races in spring. So I'm sticking with my schedule. I think it could work, but
Tour of Flanders. Okay, you can have the Tour of Flanders in spring.
Ian, what do you think? I mean, from a rider's point of view, you were talking last night, and it's something that intrigued me about how few riders can really sit down on January the 1st and say, right, this is going to be my year. I'm going to do these races. I'm going to be at my best for these, you know, two, three objectives. I need to be in form and fitness for that, and so on. And then, like all the best laid plans, everything changes, and kind of the even the stars, you know, their seasons might change if their training isn't quite on track, or they suffer illness or injury, and then that kind of ripples down through the team. And that's something I'd not really considered, you know, the knock-on effect of team leaders having their plans changed and then that ripping up the plans for everybody else. But I mean, in terms of being slightly on the other side of the fence and looking at the season as a as an observer, I mean, what do you think of the way the calendar is now, and can you kind of see a way to improve it, both for teams and riders and for spectators?
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually really like your kind of proposed calendar, Lionel. I think that having a bit more kind of clarity and the fact...
Hang on, what about mine?
Well, I mean, you're kind of a traditionalist, Richard. You want to keep the cobble classics wet. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, an issue that also kind of we didn't touch on is all these races that maybe aren't, you know, they're not UCI World Tour races, you know, they're 1.1s or 2.1s. And so then where do those races slot in? Are they kind of following the same pattern as the World Tour races? But, you know, you do have to consider what our team's going to learn from this year, just as far as preparing for races when, you know, so many riders had this huge chunk of time to get ready for, you know, a really intense block of racing. That could be something that, you know, teams start to consider going forward, is like, you know, they're going to have certain riders race at certain times of the year. But I think it's, you know, I really enjoyed seeing, you know, the best riders, you know, growing up. I always, Liège-Bastogne-Liège was a race that I always thought was, you know, one of the most beautiful one-day classics, just being kind of a climber GC guy. And the fact that over the years, that race in particular kind of lost some of its prestige. So I think, you know, having more of these races that Lionel's program would allow to, you know, really kind of have the best guys going at the best races and preparing for those. And I remember something distinctly when I was at Team Sky, kind of in the spring training camps leading up to the classics, Tim Karrison saying that, you know, just because how the schedule is organized, that, you know, their classics riders, you know, Luke Rose, Ian Standard, those guys weren't fully able to achieve their potential for the classics because they needed those guys in the Grand Tours and in the stage races and the training they needed them to be doing to help, you know, Froome or Wiggins at the Grand Tours didn't really allow them to be at their peak in the classics just because of the training they needed to do. And I think a restructured calendar would allow some of those riders to both target, you know, the classics that they want to go for as a leader, but also be a helpful domestique in the Grand Tours.
Well, chaps, earlier this evening for a wrap from the Vuelta, I spoke to our good friend Television's Daniel Freeb. Daniel, where have I caught
yes,
you?
Richard.
I can hear a lady's voice in the background.
Yes, I'm navigating while the Grand Tour season's over for me, final stage over, and I'm happily making my way to my hotel, but not driving, I hasten to add, because that would be terrible form, podcasting while driving, not allowed.
Not allowed at all. Daniel, you've reached the end. The Vuelta's reached the end. It seems to have been a great success from a health point of view, a logistical point of view. I saw a tweet of yours that said that although the Giro and the Tour had the standout tracks, the Vuelta would be the one, let me get this right, you would play on a loop. What did you mean by that exactly?
Well, Rich, I think taking in isolation, the 18 stages made up the best Grand Tour of the season, I would say, by quite some distance. I mean, you know, we had this extraordinary situation this year where all three Grand Tours were decided by less than a minute. And the Vuelta actually ended up being the closest, but I suppose most people would say that, you know, the Giro had the great finale and, well, the great last week, I suppose, or last half week. And then the Tour had the real crackerjack finish on the last Saturday. But I think the Vuelta has been the most rewarding to watch of all three because there's almost been nothing about it that's been formulaic. And, you know, I realise that most people probably only have time to tune into the highlights or they watch the finish. But if you've been able to pay a lot of attention every day to the first, you know, well, not even the first hour or two, but just to allow yourself to be engrossed and engaged by the battle most of the time between the peloton and the break has been fascinating almost every day. And there have been almost no soft breaks, you know, at the Giro. We sort of accept it and we just take it as the way the Giro goes, that the Pro Conti teams, so the Gianni Savio's team, Bardiani, they'll ping guys off down the road and that break is doomed to fail. In the Vuelta, pretty much every break was meaningful in some way and actually impacted what was happening behind, which is very unusual, I think. Partly because I think the situation that a lot of riders are in, vis-a-vis contracts, partly because of the minor competitions, you know, Guillaume Martin in the mountains competition, particularly. But every day there was something, I thought. And it was a great, if you were trying to sell Grand Tours to an uninitiated spectator, you would have had the easiest job with the Vuelta. We're actually just going past the Bernabeu Stadium, Rich, wow. The Santiago Bernabeu.
Well, yeah, I mean, Guillaume Martin, definitely one of the real winners of the Vuelta, or at the Vuelta. Hugh Carthy, another one. David Godu, another one. Carapaz, probably two, you know, backs up his Giro win last year. But Rog, I mean, are we in danger of taking Rog for granted? He had so little time to pick himself up from the disappointment of the Tour. To go to the Vuelta and perform as he did, what's more impressive about Rog? Is it, you know, the physical performance and the level, the consistency, or is it his mental strength?
Before I answer that, Rich, can I ask you whether you agree with me about, you know, the general, the sort of textured nature of the Vuelta narrative? Because, you know, inside the bubble of the race, when you're working on the race, you don't really, and especially if you're not paying that much attention to social media, you don't really know how the race is going down with other people. And I saw some comments to the effect that, you know, it wasn't the greatest race. It wasn't the most exciting. I mean, how did you feel about it?
I think, I know it burst into life, didn't it, the Vuelta, with those early stages, which were just, you know, just chaotic and unscripted in a way, and kind of mad. And, you know, I think 2 or 3 days in, I was thinking, this, you know, the Vuelta's kind of on fast forward here. This is not how a Grand Tour, you're supposed to sort of ease into it a little bit. And we, there was none of that with the Vuelta. And I worried about its ability to sustain that. I totally get what you're saying. I think with the Tour and the Giro, you always look back with hindsight, don't you? And you judge it by the finale as much as anything. And with the Vuelta, it was more sustained. What would have made it a better race, from, you know, just a point of view of suspense and drama, would have been had Carapaz been a bit closer to Rog, although the time between them was not much at all. You know, in every, whenever the crunch came, Rog was clearly superior, though he did have a couple of tough days. Well, three tough days, really, to different degrees. And those days were thrilling to watch, including obviously the Angleroo and yesterday's stage finish, Saturday's stage finish as well, and obviously the one in the rain. So I totally get what you're saying in terms of sustained interest over the 18 days. Maybe the Vuelta does edge it.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about judging Grand Tours and, you know, deciding on the whole whether they've been good or not, we generally, or people make the mistake of thinking only about the general classification. And the general classification is only really one aspect, it's one element of the race. And I think, yeah, that was very much the case here. The general classification in itself was close and it was exciting. But as I said, there were so many different interests, there were so many different objectives, and they were on display every day, and I thought that was fascinating. And, you know, the route did look back to front. It looked as though it was a soft last week, and I don't think that was the case. There were hints, there were things that affected the final outcome every day. There was that attrition that I think Mauro Vegna was aiming for when he included those very long stages in the last week of the Giro. But here they were meaningful because, and there were a lot of meters of climbing on those days, even though they might have finished in sprints or near sprints or breaks, you know, won by ruler type riders. So I think there was a wearing down process that was fascinating. The other thing is that I think sometimes, again, if we talk about the uninitiated fan, it's quite difficult to communicate to them how important the team is. I think it's very obvious, really, that the difference between Carapaz and Roglic could well have been, well, it was 24 seconds, and the team really could easily have accounted for more than 24 seconds, just in terms of, you know, on any given day, the energy that Carapaz had to spend positioning himself in the peloton and so on and so forth. And the other thing about the Vuelta, I think, was that there were a lot of days when you opened up the road book and you looked at the profile and you said to yourself, I do not know what kind of stage today is going to be. And I think that's fantastic. But to go back to your point about Rog, well, I can't remember what your point was. You asked me a question. I can't remember what it was.
I mean, I suppose we're in danger of overlooking the incredible resilience for him to come back from disappointment of the Tour and put in a performance like that over almost 3 weeks at the Vuelta.
But it's not really a surprise, is it, with Rog? Because we think that now we have, well, if there's one thing about his character that is not a mystery, it is this resilience, this hunger, really, I suppose, to absorb and really revel in any adversity that's thrown at him. You know, I do think that he goes into the most difficult days, whether it be because of weather or because of terrain or because of the circumstances in the race, with relish rather than fear.
As George Bennett told us a few days ago, you don't need mental strength when you're winning. You need mental strength when you're at the other end.
That is true. That is true. And well, I was actually talking to George Bennett at the finish today about, you know, how many more Grand Tours he thinks Rog has in him, because you look around and you think that Pogacar and others are only going to get better, and Rog is only 31, but Bennett still feels there's a lot. There are many areas in which the team can improve, and again, that sort of hunger will probably push Rog to improve. But, you know, the margins are so tiny now in Grand Tours that all of these guys are really at the mercy of the race organisers and the kind of courses that they decide to plot and the trends that we'll see develop over the next few years. I mean, we can easily see the Grand Tours sway lurched back towards the model that we were used to 10, 15 years ago with 50 kilometer time trials and so forth. I don't think they'll do that because I think, you know, they all want the suspense we've had this year, but they are beholden to whatever, you know, whether it be Javier Guillen, Mauro Vegni or Christian Prudhomme decide to do with their routes.
Well, listen, chaps, we are very grateful indeed to the riders who've been keeping audio diaries for us throughout the Grandest Tour at the Giro and at the Vuelta. And let's hear for the final time from the Vuelta, from our audio diarist, Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott.
Well, that's a wrap. Vuelta España 2020, done and dusted. Who would have thought? Amazing to have got to this point. Yeah, really big surprise that we were able to end up riding on through the whole 3 weeks with no COVID cases and get to Madrid without any issues. Just a credit to the organisation, the riders, the teams, for really investing a lot of time and effort into all the protocols that went into a safe environment for us and the fans. Also a big ups to the fans for actually staying home, watching on the TV. I'm sure that was difficult for a lot of the Spanish people, but yeah, it's what was necessary during these times, and as riders we're super grateful that it was respected and that we could ultimately get the race done because of it. The final stage today was pretty long for a final stage. It was 140k. We had quite a long old ride into the centre of Madrid. It was all on a highway, basically, to avoid going through towns, to avoid people coming out and potentially spreading the virus. But yeah, we got to the circuits, and then of course it was full gas. Sprinters teams took over, and we tried to get amongst it as well there with Rob Stenard, who ran a drama. He was in the top 10 there for the sprint. And now I'm actually already on the train home back to Girona. Quite untraditional. Normally, after a grand tour, you'd stay at least a night and have a big team dinner, celebrate, and then often meet a lot of the other riders from the bunch later to sort of catch up and chew the fat over sort of the ups and downs of the 3 weeks. But during these times, I guess that's something that's not really possible. So a lot of us are on the train back to Girona now, and considering that half the peloton actually lives in Girona, there's quite a few familiar faces on this train as well. It's really nice to have had this race done. It's been a great success getting it done, but quite late in the year now, and really, really looking forward to an off season and putting my feet up for at least a month and not thinking about turning the pedals over. Hope you've enjoyed the audio diaries. It's been a pleasure sending them in. Look forward to the next time. Cheers.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
So a question for James Morton at Science in Sport from Rob Pugh. Can you ask James about fueling for training whilst also trying to lose weight? Does he have experience of high calorie intake days for training and then lower calorie intake days when not training? What has worked well? I seem to undereat on training days and then feast the day after a non-training day. I'm struggling to find the balance. Thanks, Rob. Well, I guess, you know, in your work with Team Sky, James, this must be something you've got a lot of experience of and knowledge of.
Absolutely. I'm fortunate that I do have that experience to draw upon, but also from some of the research that we've done at Liverpool John Moores University over the last 10 years. This is without doubt the $64 million question. And my approach, Rich, really has almost to be used this mantra of fueling for the work required. And what that means is that you adjust your carbohydrate intake day by day, depending on the intensity and the durations of the ride that you have upcoming. Now, we bring this back to a weight loss question and always remember the fundamentals that to lose weight, we must be in a calorie deficit. Now, the real trick and the magic behind this is making sure that you accumulate that calorie deficit week by week. But actually, as Rob says, is deciding also within that week what days are going to be your calorie deficit days. And the simple advice in my experience of what's worked is that the days when you have intensity, so that's like your effort days above threshold, those are the days that you fuel well. So those are the days that you pay particular attention to your carbohydrate. But perhaps in those days where you might be doing real sub-maximal work below threshold, it's not that intense. There are the days that you can deliberately underfuel. And then over the course of the week, hopefully you've built up a calorie deficit to then lead to weight loss. I also think in my experience that normally we wouldn't have done large calorie deficit days for more than 2 or 3 days in a row. So you'd have a couple of calorie deficit days, then you would have a fueling day, then back into the calorie deficit day. And I think alternating with that day-by-day approach gives you the best chance of not running into any associated problems with being in the calorie deficit for a long time, which is typically what you see with a lot of World Tour riders. They push their body weight too much in too short of a period of time. And I think also reading Rob's question here, he seems to be under-eating on training days and then feasting on a non-training day. So really, Rob, we'd like you to try and do the opposite, which is to fuel your training days before, during and after. And then on those rest days, there are the days when you can actually underfuel, because of course, in keeping with fueling for the work required, then you don't need any fuel because you're not doing any work. Hopefully that makes sense for you, but you're not alone. Every athlete in the world struggles with this one.
Well, that was James Morton of Science and Sport, Director of Performance Solutions there, also Professor of Exercise, Metabolism and Nutrition at Liverpool John Moores University. He was also head nutritionist at Team Sky. Did you come across James, Ian?
Yeah, I worked with James quite closely over the years, and we still stay in touch once in a while, exchange messages. And yeah, he's an incredible wealth of knowledge, a good guy. And actually, I was always thinking about one of you guys put in a plug for asking James a question. If I'm allowed to ask a question, I'll ask one now, if that's okay.
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Well, I believe I asked this question to James a while back. Pete Kenna and I, when we would spend time together when we were living in Nice, periodically we would go have a night out. You know, indulge ourselves in too much food and too much drink. And I feel like, you know, any athlete kind of needs that to cut the strings and relax once in a while. And we tried to ask James, and I don't think he gave us an honest answer, but if you are to have a bit of a blowout, is it better to have that before a big training day or after a big training day? I mean, in the US, we're coming up to the Thanksgiving holiday, which is a holiday full of, you know, stuff in your face of food. So if that's the case, am I better off doing that after a big training ride or having a big training ride the day following?
These are the sorts of questions we like. We'll put that to James. We heard from James because, of course, we are sponsored by Science and Sport, and we're very pleased to have that association stretching all the way back to 2016. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code at the checkout, SISCP25. And if you do have a question, like Ian's, you know, when can you indulge and is it better before or after a big training ride? Email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and if you can send us an audio file, all the better. But Ian, will put your question to James. He actually got in touch as well, James, to say that he'd love to do something on the podcast with Theo Gegenhart, who he said is very interested in nutrition and somebody who pays a lot of attention to that.
Richard, I mean, I'm also very interested in nutrition. I could answer Ian's question, but I'm not sure that performance would be the main takeaway from my.
I'm not sure it's nutrition; it's more fueling, isn't it? That you're interested in.
Absolutely,
fueling.
Yeah,
always fueled. I just returning briefly to what we were talking about in the last part about this season that we've had, and in particular the last 5 weeks, the Grandest Tour. I mentioned that riders deserve a lot of credit because they've made real sacrifices, and you know, they're used cyclists to making big sacrifices. But it strikes me that, you know, even if COVID does recede or it becomes less of a problem over the next couple of years, I wonder how many of the habits that have been formed in terms of locking yourself away, limiting contact with the outside world, you know, extreme hygiene, how many of those will remain in professional cycling? Because one of the byproducts of this sort of behavior is fewer illnesses, other forms of illnesses. And what is already quite an extreme sport and an extreme way of living. And you probably saw this over the course of your career, Ian, that it just got more and more extreme. And I remember, you know, Team Sky, when they came along 10, 11 years ago, always insisting on the hand washing and the gel on the hands and all the rest of it. And you know, we thought that was a bit over the top. That obviously everybody's doing that now. Everybody in the world is doing that now. But I do fear a little bit for the things that it's asking people to do, and the more and more, you know, monk-like sacrifices they're being asked to make.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say this earlier, but I think this is going to have a huge cultural shift with athletes, because, you know, we've been in kind of this period long enough where a lot of things have become almost normal. And I think that, you know, you very quickly as a human forget what it was like before. And of course, there'll be some older riders in the peloton who, you know, are critical of how things have changed. But I see it really difficult for things to kind of go back to the way they were before. And I think, you know, there were teams kind of leading the charge as far as, you know, at Team Sky, we had a policy, a 0 days policy, which is trying to ensure that no one, you know, dropped out of a race due to illness. But a lot of other teams are, you know, obviously become aware of that, and seeing how few riders have actually pulled out of races due to other illnesses other than COVID has been exceptional, especially in the Grand Tours. And I think that's something that, to be honest, is probably here to stay.
What does that mean, Ian? Sorry, can I just ask what that means in terms of the 0 days policy? Does that mean the monitoring of health and so on would ensure as much as possible that riders don't go to races already sick or that it's caught early?
Yeah, well, I think it's a little side note before this, before I tell you what I'm going to say, but we, Team Sky in Brailsford, implemented this at a team camp in Mallorca, and Chris Froome had just arrived to camp, and as they were giving us the speech, Chris Froome was in his room pretty ill. So it was kind of ironic that as we were getting the 0 days policy, Froome already had day one of being sick. But yeah, really just to make sure that people are open and honest with each other. And I think a lot of cyclists tend to be in somewhat of denial. You know, you have some sniffles and, you know, what's the first thing you say? You say, oh, I have a cold or I have allergies and it's not much. But before you know it, it becomes a serious illness and it's spread around the team. So I think for athletes early on, diagnosing, you know, and being honest with team doctors and staff that they maybe have something and they should be isolated or in their own room and be closely monitored.
Just listening to what you were saying, Ian, about the need for riders to have a blowout every now and again, it just makes me think a couple of things. First of all, pro cycling is already a sport that favours introverted personalities. I think, you know, the fact that it does require so much kind of personal sacrifice, time away from home. I know other sports do as well, but you know, the monk-like existence and you know, the fact that increasingly there's, you know, there isn't as much well, there's certainly not like the, you know, even 10-15 years ago, riders going out in the evenings, for example, whilst on races. I mean, you know, this is an anecdotal thing, but I've seen riders in bars at the perhaps not the Tour de France, but certainly at the Vuelta towards the end of the season. And I wonder the kind of psychological impact of everyone making these sacrifices for a period of time and then going home and not being able to have that kind of release, whether it's just going out for a meal with friends and family. I mean, in a lot of Europe, that's currently not possible. So, you know, how sustainable this sort of lifestyle for all of us will be, but particularly for the athletes.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of tech and kind of, you know, software now that, you know, people are and teams are using to really identify your daily kind of health score, whether it's, you know, a wearable piece of technology that can say, you know, how you sleep, your resting heart rate, HRV, and more teams are starting to use systems like that to track riders and just kind of, you know, slowly get a better sense of, you know, how can we identify an athlete who's getting sick before they're actually sick and contagious and going to be, you know, at a dinner table with the rest of the team. So I think, you know, as with everything in our life, technology is becoming more involved and smarter. And I think more teams are going to adapt systems like that to help track their riders' health and well-being.
And yet, how suffocating might that become as well? If everything's monitored and everything, there's no leeway, you know, oh, look, you had a bad night's sleep that night. What were you doing? Well, I went out for half a dozen beers. I mean, you know, it's kind of, there is a downside as well as an upside to that kind of monitoring, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And actually at Team Sky as well, we had a system where every morning during a a race and Grand Tour in particular, you did like a quick survey of how you feel, how you think you're going to feel, which is great tidbit of data to collect and kind of see how you're anticipating on feeling. But oftentimes that information would be fed back into, you know, what your role that day would be. And oftentimes, you know, riders might wake up and feel like they didn't have a great night's sleep, but they might really perform well on a bike. So I think we're still in the early days of figuring out, you know, what do your feelings off the bike, how do those translate to feelings on the bike? And they're not always correlating.
Well, it's interesting to reflect on all that and how things might change, how that might influence things next year and beyond. But we are speaking, of course, on the final day of the Vuelta, and Primoz Roglic is the winner again for the second year in a row. And it's the second year in a row where he's finished on the podium of two Grand Tours, the Giro and the Vuelta last year, and the Tour de France and the Vuelta this year. And I think I said a couple of nights ago and last night that anybody who saw the way that Roglic reacted to his defeat at the Tour de France would have perhaps been rooting for him here, because he handled that with incredible dignity and good sportsmanship. I mean, he's looked a pretty convincing winner here. We did at one point, I think, fancy a real battle between him and Carapaz. They looked quite evenly matched, but in the end, Roglic was pretty superior and a very deserving winner. And of course, supported by an incredibly strong Jumbo-Visma team. We almost forget that he lost Tom Dumoulin pretty early on. Incredible support from them. Robert Hesink has been absolutely extraordinary at the Tour and at the Vuelta. George Bennett as well has been a great support. And Sepp Kuss, potentially our Pedler de Charme. But there are so many. I mean, the whole team has been phenomenal and deserving winner, Primoz Roglic of the Vuelta.
Yeah, I certainly think so, in not least because he won four stages. I know, well, yesterday I ran through the time gap between the two riders and the fact that Roglic had obviously done much better in terms of time bonuses taken. And I've seen a couple of sort of comments on Twitter and the sort of analysis that without the time bonuses, Richard Carapaz would have won the Vuelta by 8 seconds. And I'm not really sure. I'd be interested to know Ian's point of view on this. But I don't really think that follows, because I think if you take the time bonuses away from a Grand Tour, the riders race in a different way. If you look at the way the two riders went head-to-head over the course of the 18 stages, they finished in the same time on 11 days. So there were only 7 stages where they were separated on the road. Right back at the beginning, Roglic got 1 second ahead of Carapaz. Carapaz gained 43 seconds on the stage to Formigal, where Roglic had his problem with his jacket and perhaps his legs. And Carapaz would have been in the lead by 36 seconds after the Angliru stage. You know, it sort of switching the race around, really. Roglic then, of course, took back 49 seconds in the time trial, so would have been leading by 13 seconds going into yesterday's stage to Covatia, and then Carapaz's break at the end, gaining him 21 seconds to win, in inverted commas, by 8 seconds. But I just don't think you can look at a Grand Tour that's been raced with time bonuses, then strip out the time bonuses and come to a conclusion that the result would have been different. Because I think that if the time bonuses hadn't been available, you know, Roglic and Jumbo-Visma would have been forced to race in a different way. Richard Carapaz and Ineos would have been forced to react differently and so on. I don't know what you think, Ian, but the time bonuses being part of the Vuelta, which has become, well, as all the Grand Tours have been this year, a race of seconds, it adds a slightly different dimension when they're available on the line every day.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that, you know, the riders and the teams, they are basing their tactics off of the time they either have ahead of their opponents or the time that they're behind. So you do have to consider that, you know, teams would be racing differently if time bonuses weren't in effect. And it's, you know, in this year, especially when all three Grand Tours have come down to seconds, you know, you do start to look at, you know, are time bonuses needed? But you've also seen that very few, you know, stages are actually, we're not seeing these huge time gaps in the mountains like we saw maybe in years past. But that said, I guess, you know, what makes the race more exciting? If there were no time bonuses, would riders still be racing as aggressively? And I think the biggest change that time bonuses add, or probably the tactics, or maybe the time bonuses take away from the racing, is the tactics of the team leaders. You know, we saw that yesterday where Jumbo wasn't wanting to take back the breakaway because they wanted the time bonuses to go up the road. So, it, I mean, it, the time bonuses definitely affect the race, but I don't necessarily think they would always affect the overall stage and race winner.
Do you think that attacks would go from further out on the mountain stages if there weren't the time bonuses on the line? Because a rider knows that they can maybe gain 6 or 7 seconds on the road and then maybe another 6 or 8 or 10 seconds on the bonus. And that's a real meaningful time that's gained for a relatively risk-free type of move. You know, you're not, if you attack 4 kilometers from the top of a climb, the risk reward balance is totally different to if you attack inside the final kilometer, say.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, there were, I believe at the Tour de France, there's bonus seconds scattered throughout the stage, right? Or there's one kind of bonus climb that's the 3-2-1, which makes it more exciting for those bonuses. But yeah, you're right in saying that if riders do want to take a bigger chunk of time, I mean, taking 10 seconds time bonus at the finish line, you know, that's a pretty good chunk of time. And, you know, if riders know they can get a small, you know, 15 second gap plus 10 second bonus, you know, that's a significant difference in time. So I do think that riders would be attacking from further out if time bonuses weren't available, because that's the only opportunity to actually make a difference in time.
Does it change the attitude to time bonuses if you know that the second place rider could have won if they didn't apply? I mean, does it alter the sense that the right person has won? I mean, personally, I don't think so, because Roglic won 4 stages and Carapaz didn't win any stages. Is it a bit like the old thing about if you win a Grand Tour without taking a stage, it's you know, slightly, you know, it's a sort of 9 out of 10 win rather than a 10 out of 10 win?
No, I mean, I don't think that Carapaz is looking at the results of the Vuelta saying, oh, I would have won this race if there weren't time bonuses, because the tactics would have been different. But yeah, I mean, it does change things, and it would be interesting. I mean, honestly, I would love to hear Daniel's perspective on this, because I feel like he would, you know, this is one of those points that he would really like to contest either for or against. Time bonuses are something that we have, and I think there was a couple of years ago that they didn't have them in the Tour and they reinstated them. So yeah, I mean, racing is constantly changing and evolving, and at the moment we have time bonuses, which have really kind of been a pivotal point in who's winning these Grand Tours. But I don't think that the riders racing, either winning or losing by time bonuses, are considering that as an unfair advantage or disadvantage.
Well, if you remember back to 2011, Juan José Cobo won the Vuelta ahead of Chris Froome, largely thanks to the time bonuses that he won. And some other factors as well, which were subsequently discovered. And Chris Froome was given the overall victory, Britain's first Grand Tour victory, the 2011 Vuelta for Chris Froome. And as I said at the beginning, he has received the trophy for that victory on the day of his final race for Team Sky / Team Ineos. Quite fitting, really, Rich.
It was. I mean, he has... I spoke to Daniel about him last week during one of the episodes, because he's been a real spokesman at this race. He's been very available for interviews and so on. He has obviously not been at the level in terms of performance that he'd have liked to be at. In fact, his overall, I think he finished 98th. It's his worst ever finish in a Grand Tour. He's off to Israel Startup Nation, of course. He's still on his way back from injury. I guess the question is, how realistic is it for him to return to a level where he is going to contend for these races again? I mean, as we look around and see the sheer number of young riders in particular coming through, it's hard to imagine. But I wonder what your thoughts are, Ian. You were a teammate of Chris Froome's. You rode a couple of Vueltas with him as well. You know, what are your thoughts about where he's at now? What are his chances of do you think, of becoming a contender again? I also wanted to ask you what he was like as a team leader in these races.
Yeah, I mean, I did do two Vueltas with Froome in 2015 and 2017. He crashed out in 2015 and then 2016, and he had the devastating day up to Formigal. I mean, Froome is a phenomenal leader, and he's a rider that, you know, everyone knows his story. He kind of came from the bottom and rose to the top. He wasn't a rider that just showed up, you know, winning at a young age like a Pogacar. So I think he's, you know, he's really earned his stripes and earned his position in a team. And, you know, knowing him on a personal level, he still believes that he can come back and win his fifth Tour de France, and he's going to fight for that. But I think that, you know, the odds are definitely against him, just seeing how he's kind of come back this year. And he's improving, but will he reach that same level? And will he be able to reach the level of some of these young stars? It's going to be challenging, but I think he still has a lot of value in any team, just with the experience he has, having won so many Grand Tours and leading teams to be involved and be a part of these, you know, Tour de France teams, and being a valuable asset going forward to really guide and navigate these teams, as, you know, a team like Israel, who, you know, has never contested a Grand Tour overall. You know, he has the experience that, you know, is really hard to get.
If you're interested in that 2011 Vuelta, of course, we released an episode, Kilometer Zero, during the Vuelta last year, with Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins talking through the race, because it was a very important race for both of them, actually. In hindsight, even more important for Froome than we realised at the time. But it's a fascinating story, and I found Froome to be very good reliving that and remembering the details, because he's been not the best interview when he's been in in the yellow jersey at the Tour de France, say, not great in the moment, but when and we've seen it this Vuelta as well, when he's asked about other riders or about how the race is going, or about things that have happened in the past, he's actually pretty good. So that's worth digging out if you're interested in the story of the 2011 Vuelta. I mean, one thing that I've been thinking about, as we reflect already on this strange season and on the last 5 weeks in particular, you know, you mentioned it earlier, Lionel, that when racing stopped in March, there were lots of, you know, dire predictions about what it would do to professional cycling, that some teams might not return, that races would disappear, and so on. And it does feel, I guess it's felt all the way through, like a bonus that we've had racing, and that we've had so much racing. And it's really given an opportunity to some riders to step forward and step up. And, you know, nobody would know about Mark Hirschi if we hadn't had racing this year. Hugh Carthy, another one who, you know, has finished on the podium at the Vuelta. Filippo Ganna at the Giro. Even Richie Porte, you know, finishing on the podium at the Tour de France. These sorts of results so valuable to these riders. Wout van Aert, you know, his incredible form and victories as well. It's been, you know, when you think about the value of the racing that we've had to those guys, it's obviously enormous. But I think to everybody, you know, fans as well, have had a new appreciation for bike racing. And I just wanted to pick out a couple of memories. I think you've got riders that you're going to pick out, Lionel. But I was at the start of the Giro the first 11 days, and The overriding memory actually is a day where it looked like the race was in the balance. It was Lanciano before stage 10, the day after the rest day, when we'd got the news about quite a few COVID positives at Michelin Scott. They were out the race, and Steven Kruijswijk at Jumbo-Visma also tested positive, and they made a late decision, Jumbo-Visma, to pull out. And I you know, I'll always remember Andy Engels, the sports director, a very somber mood, explaining to us the reason for them pulling out the race, for which I thought they deserved credit, but they ended up getting criticised by Mauro Vegni, the Giro director. Also then, a week later, at the 3 days of Dipana, it was the last sort of classic of the year, and it felt a bit like sneaking into a bar just before last orders and getting a lock-in, because Belgium wasn't closing, it was actually closed, you know, everything was closed, but there was this bike race going on. And it was wonderfully sort of low-key, low-fi. I spoke to Mark Cavendish in a car park by a leisure centre. There was a sort of pointlessness to it, it felt like. And yet, the riders were so committed to it. And they rode it as if it was a world championship. Yves Lampaert was the winner. And it was just bike racing for its own sake and in horrific conditions. And for some reason, I just really, really enjoyed it. Again, because I knew it was the last one of the year and that we were lucky to have it.
Well, if you're going to have a lock-in anywhere, Belgium's probably not a bad place, is it? Got some lovely beers.
But who are your standout riders from the last 5 weeks?
Well, I was actually going to do teams, Rich, rather than individual riders.
Oh,
I've come up with a ranking system to rival the UCI's team ranking system. Movistar haven't won it. Ineos have won it because of Teo Gegenhardt's win at the Giro, the 7-stage wins in the Giro, and Canapaz being on the podium at the Vuelta. Pushed very hard by Jumbo-Visma. The standout rider there, Primoz Roglic, but obviously Wout van Aert as well, very visible. Well, he's on the podium, second by a whisker in the Tour of Flanders, of course.
Let's not forget Liège-Bastogne-Liège as well, which falls under our grandest tour. It was right at the start of the grandest
Tour.
Absolutely.
Roglic won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, of course, as well. And then a very close race for third place on the podium between De Koenig Quickstep. They had the young star of the Giro, João Almeida, and of course Yves Lampaert won the 3 days of Dapana. Then EF Pro Cycling, sort of surprising there, but then they had two stage wins in the King of the Mountains jersey in the Giro, and Hugh Carthy on the podium at the Vuelta, and then Groupama FDJ just behind EF, Arnaud Démare's handful of stage wins at the Giro, and of course David Godu with his two stage wins in the Vuelta. So, you know, some real, I think those five teams really, and I mean Sunweb as well, of course, you know, with two riders on the podium at the Giro, but in my unique point system, that didn't net them as many points as if you won stages and held jerseys. But, you know, the point system, like the Kentucky Fried Chicken recipe, will remain a secret.
Well, Ian, what are your standouts from the last 5 weeks? Don't talk about the, what was it, steelheads that you caught in the river, but the cycling related.
Yeah, well, I mean I think the clear kind of the most successful rider over the Grandest Tour would have to be Roglic with Liège and then the Vuelta. But, you know, I'm going to go with three riders who, you know, really use the Grandest Tour to show themselves and kind of set them up for the future. And those are the young riders of Teo, of Hindley, and of Hugh Carthy. I mean, those three riders, you know, really kind of came onto the stage over the last 32 stages and, you know, have made a name for themselves. And, you know, it's not often that you see, you know, riders, you know, most in particular Hugh, who's kind of been at it for a while, and, you know, both Teo and Hindley are, you know, have been big talents from the beginning of their pro careers, and they were brought into the teams that they're in because they were kind of being touted as Grand Tour, you know, hopefuls. But you know, Hugh's performance here at the Vuelta has really kind of been a standout performance for myself.
Yeah, Ian, I'd definitely say Hugh Carthy, one of the stars of the Vuelta, not least because of his fantastic interview conversation with Mitch Docker in Life in the Peloton, in which he opened up about all manner of things but didn't express an opinion on Preston bus station, one of the few things he didn't express an opinion on. But let's hear from Mitch Docker of EF Pro Cycling, who has sent in a few updates throughout the Vuelta and will return, of course, with the final episode of the year for his podcast Life in the Peloton in 10 days or so's time. But let's hear Mitch's final dispatch recorded before the last stage of the Vuelta.
Well, so here we are, the morning of the Madrid stage. It is only stage 18, but I can tell you, and I can speak for, I think, behalf of the whole peloton, it really does feel like stage 21. And I think for a lot of reasons. At the end of the day, it is the 8th of November, and a lot of us are probably kicking back or have already had our whole off season and maybe starting to get back into it. So to be racing this time of year is first of all strange, but to be racing a Grand Tour this time of year and feeling that kind of fatigue and that kind of needing that kind of motivation has also been a bit of a strain. That's not also to say about the parcours. I think it has been a bloody tough race, and me not being a climber, it's probably easy for me to say, but, you know, even just listening to some of the climbers and the way this race has been raced, there really hasn't been an easy day. And I feel like that is the general consensus from every Grand Tour we go to. But this one, I really think we really had one day that I can remember where we rolled in. But in saying all that, we've had a fantastic tour as a team. And that has been something that has kept me personally inspired throughout this tough race at the end of the year in the cold, dreary weather. First of all, Mike Woods getting his win just to light the fire. Then Hugh winning above, you know, on top of the favourites there at the Angrelou. You know, that was just amazing. But then the surprise victory with Magnus Cort Nielsen the other day. Yeah, that was just like, it solidified what this team has been doing here and the teamwork and how well we've got on off the bike as well. The stuff we do on the bike, it's sort of just become clockwork. That's just what we do, and there's been no stress. If people could do their job, it was great. If they couldn't, there was no questions asked because we knew we were giving our best. And I feel like that's just shone through with the end result with Hugh. He's, like I said, climbing the mountain. He's becoming this new man on the scene, and he's really relished in this opportunity, and he's taken it on, and it's been great to watch. Watch him be a leader. Watch how he's handled this new pressure, and he's really handled it well, physically and mentally. So I think, to wrap it all up, it's been a bloody tough race. Lots of highs for us, but certainly some very tough moments in the race. But I'm very, very excited to be here in Madrid, and I'm going to be very happy to be home tomorrow drinking a cold beer. That is for sure.
That was Mitch Docker, and we'll be hearing from him again in Life in the Peloton next week. And that pretty much concludes our coverage from the Grandest Tour. We've got quite a lot of thank yous. It's been a long but enjoyable 5 weeks. Palermo seems like a long, long time ago for the start of the Giro. We started off our coverage on the ground at the Giro, myself and Daniel, and then operations moved to our respective homes, and Lionel and I were joined by a rotating cast of presenters, Lizzie Banks, Francois Tomazo, and Ian Botswell. Thank you, Ian, but thanks also to Lizzie and Francois, and thanks to Daniel as well, of course. Big thanks to our sponsors, iWalk, our title sponsor, Science and Sport, and Zwift, who supported our Kilometre Zero series.
A big thank you to our producers, John Mooney, Tom Wally, Adam Bowie, and Will Jones, and also Jonathan Rowe, who keeps things ticking along on social media and doing lots of other things behind the scenes.
And a big thanks to David Luxton as well, who similarly keeps things going behind the scenes and keeps us sane. But we'll be back this week with our press conference episode, as I said earlier, and we'll revert to our weekly episodes, monthly Cycling Podcast Féminin, Explore, and Service Course as well. But Ian, thank you very much for being part of our team.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me as part of this, the Grandest Tour. It's been quite the journey for you too, and once again, congratulations on making it to the finish.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, guys. There.